introduce Jennifer Tucker, our graduate student speaker. Jennifer's research is motivated by questions of urban justice and Latin American cities. Her current project studies urban work, livelihood, and frontier city building on the Paraguay-Brazil border, home to the largest informal borders economy on the continent. In addition to prior work as a community organizer and development practitioner in the U.S., Paraguay, and Peru, she has a long history of community activism on issues of environmental, labor, and social justice. Jennifer looks forward to relocating to the land of enchantment this fall. That's New Mexico, in order to join the community and regional planning faculty at the University of New Mexico. Jennifer.
CED graduating class of 2016. It's such an honor to be with you here today, gathered with so many friends and family who have made this long journey possible. As we stand together on this threshold, I want to talk to you about hope in the face of austerity and uncertainty. As students, we are constantly pushed just beyond our comfort zone as we learn new skills or ways of thinking about the world. So it's fitting that one of my last tasks here will be to explore a new genre of a communication for me, the 7-minute inspirational speech. Luckily, I've been trained here at Berkeley, still the best public institution of higher education in the world. Faced with learning in an unfamiliar form, I drew from the many strategies I learned through my graduate training. So my first task, obviously, was to Google top 10 commencement speeches. Of course, I found a searchable database of 350 commencement speeches and a comprehensive analysis of what constitutes a good one. Apparently, in addition to being inspirational, I must also be funny, self-deprecating, and include meta-commentary on the genre itself. Learning this did not calm my nerves. Nonetheless, I have given myself an additional challenge. I will only allow myself one butterfly metaphor. However, be warned, I'm a DCRP PhD student drawing from critical urban studies and development theory. Thus, I vehemently refuse any limits on the terms co-constitution, the relational production of space, or the epistemological function of praxis. As a generation, we face unprecedented challenges: the threat of global climate catastrophe, a rigged economy, skyrocketing inequality, and the rise of overt hate-based electoral politics. In response, we must link imagination and ethical action, both rooted in a commitment to the public. As planners and designers, we are oriented towards the future. One medium of our work is the imagination. The CED vision statement names transcendent ways of seeing and a contextual, critical approach to understanding cities as a necessary foundation for interventions into the built environment. The CED vision statement names the city of these values: sustainable, fair, prosperous, beautiful, healthy, and I would add, just. Economics, education, and the urban come together in this vision, and reimagining what each can be is our millennial task. The dominant economic philosophy would have us believe that society is just a collection of individual consumers, that human relations are defined by competition, and that the market efficiently allocates scarce resources. Perhaps the most dangerous feature of this economic ideology is that it suppresses alternative ways of imagining society, as Margaret Thatcher thought to do when she said there is no alternative. Put into action, this neoliberal economic logic transforms public goods into commodities. The view that education is a commodity today holds sway in Sacramento and among some UC administrators. This logic transforms students into consumers of a product and a source of revenue. When paired with state budget cuts and relentless austerity politics, seeing education as a commodity yields tragedies. Instruction becomes a labor cost to be minimized. Low-wage adjunct professors with PhDs but without job security are the new faculty majority, now teaching more than half the courses at U.S. colleges. As the state backs away from its historic commitment to guarantee access to higher education for all Californians, tuition rises and new fees emerge, like the CED professional degree fee. Debt-financed education is the new norm, and total outstanding student loan debt recently topped $1.2 trillion in the U.S., and that's trillion with a T. We must ask who is excluded from this education model. The same economic logic shapes cities in the built environment. For example, in 2014, Twitter and other mid-market tech firms benefited from a $34 million tax break in the midst of a housing and displacement crisis that is driving many longtime residents from San Francisco. In cities like ours, where extreme wealth and poverty coexist, public spaces force us to confront inequality and engage across racial and class difference rather than retreat to segregated enclaves. Confronting entrenched political and economic interests is no easy task. To remind myself of this, I've pinned a photo of Martin Luther King to my refrigerator. MLK looks straight at you. His eyes are fierce with determination. Around his neck hang the number 7089, because the photo is a mugshot. During the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King was arrested 29 times. This photo reminds me that hope springs from risk, from bold imaginations of what we can build together, and from nonviolent civil disobedience. In this spirit, in 2011, I joined thousands of public education activists organizing against fee hikes in the UC system. As I helped organize Mass Direct Action in Sacramento, a group of brilliant landscape architecture students floated a tent high above Sproul Hall with words that simply said, "Our space." These students imaginatively reclaimed the Sproul lawn just weeks after UC police had violently evicted the tent encampment of Occupy Cal protesters. Our bold and creative movement helped win the current freeze on tuition hikes in the UC system. Woo! The public education movement exemplified praxis, what the Brazilian educator Paulo Freire calls action and reflection upon the world in order to change it. Public education activism has been one key piece of my own praxis, the ongoing work of making my civic and ethical self. That's because we don't come to the public university to be filled up with information and skills as if we were empty vessels. We come to the public university to learn how to live, and to learn how to learn, but also to learn how to think and act in a troubled world in ways that bind together action and reflection. It is in this sense that the Black feminist scholar and activist bell hooks says that education is the practice of freedom, a freedom linked to the reciprocal relationship of critical awareness and engagement. Of course, classrooms are not always spaces of freedom. Multiple possibilities always exist in classrooms, in universities, in cities. These spaces can tend towards freedom or domination, towards justice or inequality. I imagine many of you have sat in classes where boredom circulated like butterflies, or where instructors reinforce the social norms of power and authority that buttress an unequal world. It's up to us to put these spaces towards justice. Here, we must learn from Black feminists like Angela Davis, from whom I borrow the term the epistemological function of praxis. I know that it's a mouthful, but it's important. We've already talked about praxis, the bridging of action and critical reflection. Epistemology is a theory of knowledge or a way of understanding how the world works. Feminists have long insisted that all knowledge is shaped by social structures of power. Black feminists teach us that systems of oppression like racism and sexism are interlocking and overlapping. They also teach us that dominant epistemologies or ways of understanding the world can smuggle in harmful, untrue assumptions, like the assumption that education is a commodity, or that markets are neutral arenas that allocate resources efficiently, or that racism is a problem of the past rather than a present-day reality, or that displacement and gentrification are inevitable. This is why the epistemological function of praxis is so crucial, because as we act to change the world out of a critical consciousness, our own ways of understanding change. Our sense of who we are and where the limits of the possible lie are transformed. We need public universities and public spaces to nurture this kind of transformative thinking. It's a public commitment to accessible education that ensures diverse classrooms and enables encounters across all sorts of difference that pushes us towards a more critical collective consciousness. This is especially true for planning and architecture, as we are the scholars and the practitioners who will shape the cities of tomorrow. This moment of our graduation is marked by profound challenges, but also by hopeful reevaluations of assumptions thought settled in the 20th century. In our young century, gay marriage is redefining family and gender. In our young century, the Occupy movement has sparked national debate on economic inequality, while anti-eviction campaigners are reimagining housing as a right and not a commodity. In our young century, the Black Lives Matter movement offers a life-affirming vision for a less violent and more racially just world. The novelist Arundhati Roy says, "Another world is not only possible, she is on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing." Together, let us imagine and struggle for cities and schools that are spaces of justice and freedom. Thank you.